WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We have three horns, saxophone, cornet, trombone, percussion, trap drums, Fender bass, electric guitar. And that's what it looks like. We play rhythmic music, and we add, it's like cooking, I guess, you know. If you put we put the water there, you know, we just throw stuff in. Foreign vegetables from Jersey, you know, tomatoes from Mexico, okra from Mississippi. So it's a mixture of the American music and American rhythms that I like, and it's also a mixture of other foreign rhythms that I've experienced, you know. So anything that I like deep inside of my heart, that's what you're going to hear. You're going to hear some of it, not anything. You're going to hear some of it tonight.
I understand that people frequently get up and dance at your concerts, and it's not typical for jazz audiences to be dancing. That might have to do with the people who go to jazz concerts not remembering mm-hmm. how to dance, and it might have to do with the music. I don't know which, but is it hard to get people on their feet at concerts?
It depends. Sometimes I'll play something that will get them up. Other times, if I don't feel like playing music on that level, you know, they don't get up. So it depends on how I feel sometimes. I know exactly sometimes the mood of an audience, you know, sometimes. I watch them just like they watch me, see. So they pay to see me, I pay to see them.
It's funny in a way. I think it was the avant-garde that made jazz music into a concert music as opposed to a dance music. And now it seems to be the avant-garde that's reforming it into a dance music again, or at least sometimes a dance music. Do you think that's true?
Well, I understand what you're saying. Yeah, a lot of the musicians who are playing what they call avant-garde music, they were in dance bands from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, you find that they were, as teenagers, preteens, their first experience was in dance bands. That's in my case and in a lot of other musicians' cases.
You grew up in Mississippi. What was the music around you when you were young?
I would say everything as far as American music is concerned, you know, everything, you know. Well, they had classical concerts there. They had blues musicians right in town, gospel people right down the street, you know, secular music, jazz. I think I saw everything there. I think it was right there in a composite small town, but it was right there.
How did you choose trumpet as an instrument?
Well, let's see what happened. This guy came in town. We didn't have a band at all. At least the young kids didn't. We didn't have a band. This guy came in town from Cleveland. His name was Lavander Kynes. And he had no place to stay. I remember this vividly. I think I was about 9 or 10. And my godparents had a vacant lot with an old, unused church there. So they gave him this place to stay for, you know, till he got himself together. And he would call the children in off the street, you know, show them what he had collected or whatever, paintings. He was a painter. He had books already published and whatever. He spoke foreign languages or whatever, and we were fascinated by this man. So it wasn't long after he went and got some old instruments from a college there, Natchez College, and just put them out on the table. And we came in and I picked the first thing I saw, which was a clarinet. And I played the clarinet for about a week. I had never seen a trumpet up close. Then the next day, I saw my friend with the trumpet and asked him, where did he get it? And he said, in the next room. So I went in the next room and got the trumpet. And that was it. No, it wasn't a trumpet. It was a cornet, as a matter of fact. And I got it and started playing with Professor Kynes.
What was better about the cornet than the clarinet?
I just liked the way it looked. It was stronger. I had seen Louis Armstrong on television. He made a big impression, and that was it.
What were you playing at the beginning?
What do you mean?
What did you want to play at the beginning?
I didn't want to play anything.
You just wanted to hold it?
I just wanted to be a part of the situation, you know what I mean? I just wanted to be one of the kids with an instrument. So the trumpet was it. That's the one. I liked the way it looked, and I heard Satch play it. So it was no contest.
What kind of music did you end up playing in the school band, if you were in it, and in your in bands with friends?
Well, regular stock books in the school bands, you had to play actually what the principal wanted, you know, the school system wanted, which was John Philip Sousa marches and Glenn Miller. I mean, for really funky stuff, you played Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman, stock arrangements. And we would make up our own stuff on the side, you know, until the principal came and said, no. So we had just about anything, you know. We had classical stuff, semi-classical stuff. We didn't go too deeply into anything, you know.
When did you start listening to jazz and learning about jazz other than the kind that you were doing in school?
Well, I had an experience hanging out in a little bar. Teenage boys used to hang out in and sneak a beer, you know. And they had 145 on here, on this jukebox. It was Art Blakey, Clifford Brown. Just 145. Nobody listened to it but me. I mean, I ran that thing until the holes went through the grooves. And that was my experience. I really didn't know what that music was, where they came from, what it meant. I just liked the way it sounded. It was just different from all the stuff I heard down there. It was different. I just liked it because it was different.
How did you pursue it after that? Was it hard to find more?
There it was. You know, for me, I was young. I was young, and I'm quite sure there were some older guys dealing with it, but they had traveled outside of Natchez, and they would talk about these things. It was fun. They used to call me Ray Anthony because I played tenderly all the time. They used to say I was square or whatever. They just laughed and say, oh, man, get out of here. You know, so I didn't get a chance to deal with it there. But when I went away to Nashville to college, I mean, it was right there in front of my eyes. I mean, right on the campus, they had these speakers, you know. After school, the speakers would come on. The first sound I heard was like John Coltrane, Moment's Notice, you know. And that was like, I said, where do these people come from? It was like these people were from another whole place to me, like outside of America. It could have been from anywhere. I never heard that kind of music before, and it fascinated me because I was an instrumentalist. Usually, that kind of music would fascinate musicians, instrumentalists or whatever, because we were more sophisticated about musical forms rather than the average layman. I always found that to be true. And my roommate and a lot of my friends, you know, freshmen in college or whatever, these guys had records of Miles Davis. I never heard of Miles Davis. I never heard of Coltrane. I never heard of anybody. But Clifford Brown or Art Blakey on this 45. So these guys introduced me to this music, and they would hum all the solos and whatever. And a lot of guys weren't even musicians. They were just, some guys were swimmers, basketball players, you know, horticulture majors or whatever. But it's not like it is nowadays, I'm quite sure. It was the teenagers listened to everything then. This was in the South. We listened to everything. If it was there, we would listen to it. Now, in Mississippi, we couldn't go to a record store and go through a bin and see jazz records. So, and it wasn't on the radio. Not where I'm from, you know, it wasn't on the radio. So when I was 17, I went to Nashville, and there it was. So I played music in the band while I was majoring in pre-med or whatever.
I think that experience would have been enough for a lot of people to give up music, because when you've been playing for a few years and you realize that there's this great stuff that you'd never heard before, it could be really overwhelming, and because of that, very frustrating.
Well, not even that. It was the musicians that I was playing with in college, the teenagers, that overwhelmed me. I was like big thing in my high school. You know, I could play and that was bad, you know. But when I got to college, which was Tennessee State in Nashville, they needed 15 trumpet players for the band, and I thought I was cool. You know, I was going to be number one because I was number one in high school. I was number 15. You know, these guys were great. So it was discouraging in a way, but it wasn't. I knew that I wasn't going to be, you know, top trumpeter or going to even be recognized at all, which I was not. You know, these guys were great musicians. They all turned out to be, they went to other means. They took other means in life. They went into whatever, not music. I haven't met one that was really into music. Some of it Motown, you know, playing just lead trumpet, but I met guys who were like great, 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 great. If they were out here right now, they would be sitting here instead of me. I was number 15. And I still would be, I think, if they had gone. But I was fortunate to leave school because I didn't get a chance to participate with the great young musicians at school. So I was angry about it.
Well, you know? You started off as a pre-med student in school and ended up as a professional musician. Yeah. Where did that switch happen?
It happened when I left school and I joined the Navy. And I was going to be a radio man. And
on the air or repairing?
No, repairing radios, you know. I didn't make it. So what did I do? Oh, they were auditioning musicians in boot camp, you know, but you have to be special. You have to have recommendations and all this. I just sneaked over there because I knew musicians were kind of cool anyway. I sneaked over. The guy said, can you play Tuxedo Junction or whatever? Whatever it was, whatever it sounded like. I said, yeah. I faked through it. He said, yeah, go to music school. It was just that easy. So I went to Navy School of Music for a year or so, you know. And I got into music for 4 years, see, in the Navy. That's what really got me back into it, just being in the Navy, being around the environment.
What were you playing in the Navy? I'd imagine it being the same Susan Marches and Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman's house.
Oh, no, it was different in the Navy. You did it all. It was different. See, they had a jazz band. They had a small combo. I was in a small combo. You go out and play little parties for the officers and whatever. Then you play your jazz tunes, Bunny Hop or whatever. Play requests out of fake books or whatever. And then you play the big band concerts for dances, big dances. You know, you play the bassy arrangements and stuff like that. We did our own arrangements. And we played concert music just to rehearse it. Every now and then we'd get a little concert in a little small town. And we played marches. It was everything. So it was a full experience playing in the Navy, you know.
So that's you did you have to do other things, or
mm-mm.
Was your job really to be a musician the whole time?
Just clean up when I was a bad boy, you know, screw up the floors or something like that, you know.
Well, let's take a break here and listen to some more of your music. And my guest is Olu Dara, who's a cornetist and composer, and he'll be performing with his band, the Ochre Orchestra, tonight at Haverford College, and the concert starts at 8. It's in Roberts Hall, and in case you don't know how to get to Haverford, let me give you a phone number you can call for information. It's 896-6606. And by the way, you may know that Henry Threadgill usually performs in his sextet, but he just returned from India and will not be performing. Usually performs in the orchestra is what I mean. But he just returned from India and will not be performing this evening at Haverford College. Who will be replacing
now,
him?
Now, Vincent Henry will be replacing Henry Threadgill. He plays guitar. I don't know who he's going to play tonight. I don't even know what he brought with him. He plays saxophone, guitar, harmonica.
Okay. Well, we're going to listen to a selection from the David Murray album Ming, and we're going to hear a piece called Dewey Circle, in which Olu Dara is featured on cornet. And do you want to say anything about this piece or
well,
the session?
I would say one thing about this piece. I had never attempted to play this type of style of trumpet, not really, before David wrote this song. I used to listen to this style of trumpet. It's like a southern, you know, trumpet style, what they may call Dixieland or whatever. It's my first attempt ever anywhere to do this. And I really know if I could do it or not, if I had it in me or not. So this is a good documentation of my first try. And now that's my love.
Great. Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Dewey Circle, composed by David Murray, my guest Olu Dara on cornet.
We'll be right back.
Dewey Circle from the David Murray Octet album Ming, and my guest Oludaro was featured on cornet, and he'll be leading his own band, the Ochre Orchestra, tonight at Haverford College. The concert's in Roberts Hall on the Haverford campus. It starts at 8 o'clock, and a number that you can call for more information and directions is 896-6606. Well, we left off just at the point in our conversation where you had joined the Navy. We're performing in the band there, learning a lot, enjoying the music, playing with good musicians. The band took you, the Navy is what first got you to New York in, I guess it was 1963. Did you ever plan on living there when you got there then?
Living in New York? You know, for a minute I thought I was still in New York. When you said there.
Where?
Right. No, that was the furthest thing away from my mind. I'm a country boy, you know, I'm used to fruit trees and, you know, peaches in the yard and just cooling out. I just, I was discharged here with about $300. So I was planning on going to Spain to play because I had seen Lou Bennett and Lex Humphries in Barcelona. And I liked the atmosphere over there. And I wanted to go there to try to learn how to play. And that didn't work out. So I had another plan to go back down south and finish college. Then I said, no, I probably wind up as a band director or something. So I stayed in New York.
Well, how did you chart out what you're going to do? New York's a big place, and it's hard to
get
known.
I didn't chart out. For 8 months, I didn't know what was going on. You know, I just stayed in. Just go out every now and then and hear some music and looking for day jobs. Because I wasn't really planning on being a musician. After being living in New York, I would say not really being in music all the way. I was always a type of guy who just played because there was an opportunity to play. I never thought about one day I'm going to be a professional musician. You know, it wasn't like that with me. You know, I just did whatever came along, you know, musically. So I just went out and listened, and I found various day jobs here and there. You know, I think I was planning on going back to school in New York. You know, I was going to probably go to law school or something like that. You know, I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do, really.
What happened to change your mind and make you stay in music?
Well, I started running into guys who I met in the Navy, guys like Hammett Blewett and people like that who I'd run across in the Navy, and they say, man, you don't play trumpet anymore? I said, no, I gave that stuff up, man. I was like in real estate, and I was running discos and stuff like that. I was always doing stuff like that, you know. I worked for a Japanese newspaper company and a lot of things, you know. Just having fun, working, making money, you know. But these guys influenced me. And I ran into, what really got me back in was I was hanging out one weekend with my friend, who was a trumpet player also, but he has put his trumpet down just like me and, you know, started working regular jobs or whatever. And he's always trying to get me to play. He said, go ahead and play with somebody, man, you good. So it's a rhythm and blues band working on weekends, so I joined them, you know, just on weekends, you know. And I got to liking it. And after that, I got a gig with Hair. Went out, this was like 1970, the original road company. And that got, you know, the bug got in me. You know, so I just stayed stuck with it. I really didn't know if I was going to stay with it anyway, because I dropped in, dropped out. Even when I played with Blakey, after I finished with that, I dropped out of it again, because I really didn't like, you know, traveling that much. I traveled so much anyway when I was very young. I really didn't like a lot of things about the music business.
Did you fit into Blakey's band? Because I don't think of the Messengers as being the kind of music that you play.
Not at first, but he hired me. He liked something about me. I fit in very good. I did. That's where I got my Okra act from, you know. Some people say that's one of the best bands they heard because we entertained. We just didn't stand up there and just blow a lot of notes. I sang. That's where I started trying to sing with him, tell jokes with him. He didn't mind. And I danced. We had a crazy band, though. Cedric Lawson, Carter Jefferson. We were all good friends. Stafford James. It was a different type of Messenger band. It's probably why we never got recorded. But it was a very successful year we spent with him. Musically, it was exciting for me because we didn't have to play. I never liked the idea of just standing up and just playing bebop phrases. It never did anything for me. Having a straight face, you know, standing on the side while another guy blows and another guy blows, and then I walk back and play the melody. It's not my kind of thing, you know. And Art understood the way I felt about it. He understood. Cedric Lawson, the piano player, had the same feeling. He was like a comedian himself, a little bit crazy too. He would jump up off the piano and sing or recite poetry. And like, we spent most of our time in Europe and Japan when we were with him. But we did some things in the States too. Did the same thing. But it was a different Messenger band, believe me.
I think that that kind of approach to entertainment was really frowned on for a long time in jazz?
Oh, I'm quite sure it was. But see, I didn't come from that kind of background. Like I say, I'm from Mississippi. And when I moved to the East Coast, they had another attitude about our presentation of music. Jazz, I used to always envision, when I used to hear the word jazz, musicians, you know, dancing, you know, doing acrobatic stunts or whatever. I didn't know what they did. All I wanted to do was see it. And just see something, you know, because I'd seen things down south like the minstrel shows. Not really minstrel, what do they call them? Silas Green and some other kind of thing. Rabbit's Foot, you know. These guys were playing jazz too, I guess. But it was exciting. It was creative. And it wasn't poker-faced at all. And it wasn't cloned. Everybody tried to do something different. I don't know if they call these guys jazz musicians or not, but that's what I thought jazz was. I got to New York and I saw it was like, you know.
I think that for a while people were afraid that if you did that kind of thing on stage that you'd be clowning in a showbiz way that might be demeaning and detract from the seriousness of the music. And that also might be perceived as tomming.
Well, let's see. Depends on the individual, I guess. I mean, me, I enjoy myself just like I did when I was a kid. I'm the same way I was when I was in high school, you know, messing around in school and clowning and having fun. You know, I see myself, I like, you know, myself, and I hope most people do. You know what I mean? So I never really got into how people were looking at me as this and that. I wasn't raised that way. I was raised to enjoy yourself, you know. And if you're performing in front of an audience, let them enjoy themselves. Help them to enjoy themselves.
You studied tap dancing when you were young, didn't you?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Do you use that now in your performance?
No, because I don't wear tap shoes anymore. But I act sometimes in little vignettes, or I may do plays every now and then. I was in a play a couple of years ago called The Last Minstrel Show. We did it in Boston, and we did it in at Rutgers. It never came to New York because of what you were saying, that people were saying that was blah, 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 blah. But I tapped there, danced and sing, and that I really regretted that we didn't come to New York and do it, because that's what I really like to do, be on stage. And we were playing instruments, too. So you had all the actors played instruments, danced, sang, and acted. To me, that's it. You know what I mean? That's it. When you do that, that's the way I always envision musicians, entertainers, or whatever, you know.
Do you want to do, like, more music theater?
I would like to. As soon as I get a chance, if I get a break from playing with a lot of other bands, I'm going to take the Oka Orchestra. I've done it before when we do concerts in small theaters and where I have time to put my show together. It's theatrical. Now, tonight will be semi-theatrical, you know, semi. But I would like to get the Oka Orchestra as a troupe, entertainment troupe, not just a jazz band. I don't want to even be called a jazz band, you know what I mean? We're going to play that anyway, you know. But I would like for these people and myself to entertain, you know. Tap dance. I want to do all the things I know how to do well. Things that's been done before hasn't been seen since. If you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Since jazz isn't really a mainstream music anymore, like you really have to go out of your way to hear it, either on the radio or in person. It's not as pervasive as rock music is. Is it troubling to you since you play a music that, I mean, I think would have a pretty wide appeal if people heard it, but how many people actually go to jazz clubs or tune in jazz stations and
well,
stuff?
Well, you can't. They like you. We were talking earlier. It's expensive. First of all, you don't have enough room to move around. It's not enough theater involved in the music. It's not enough entertainment involved in the music. Sometimes you go to jazz clubs and guys are like they had a high school recital or a college recital, but they say they're playing jazz, and you have all kinds of musicians who call themselves jazz musicians, and they don't only call themselves jazz musicians. The press calls them jazz musicians, so people go out and hear some guy, and they say this is their first experience, and they go see hear some guy. He's called a jazz musician. They see this guy and they say, well, look. Look here, Martha, we can't go here anymore. This guy tells his wife, look, Martha, this is what you're talking about, jazz? No, we can't, I'm sorry. So he doesn't go anymore. The family doesn't go anymore because they saw somebody misrepresenting what it is. If you pick up a magazine, you find 1,000 guys are called jazz musicians. You listen to a jazz radio station, you see all kinds of people. You know what I mean? You find Eskimos jazz musicians. You know, it doesn't matter. You hear a guy just banging on a bell. He's playing jazz. I mean, in New York especially, if you can listen to the, you know, you hear some stuff. This is a new jazz artist from blah, 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 blah. You know, so therefore you confuse the public with that, you know. And before, they didn't confuse the public. When they said jazz, I'm quite sure people saw guys with these hats, these nice, dressed nice, you know, having a good time and playing that good time music, you know. And it's hard to get back. I've been trying to get back into it, but it's hard in a way. It'll change, but it's hard right now. You know, the rock, what you call rock, rhythm and blues, other types of music, they've taken the place. Like Stevie Wonder, these people, they should call some of these people jazz because they do the things that jazz musicians used to do. They dress flamboyantly, You understand? They compose great music. But they call them rock, they call them rhythm and blues or whatever. They use the same techniques, you know?
Have you been influenced a lot by some of the trumpeters in Ellington's bands and in their use of smears and mutes and other things to change the growls, other things to change the sound
of
the trumpet?
I must be, because I never listened to Ellington until one guy said, you sound like blah, blah, blah in Ellington's band. I never listened to Duke Ellington's band when I was growing up. It didn't move me. That was like, to me, that was classical music.
Really?
It was classical music. If I wanted to listen to a big band jazz, I would listen to Count Basie. Maybe because of peer pressure or whatever, my environment. They listened to Count Basie, so I listened to Count Basie. But I didn't listen to Duke Ellington until I was in my, I'm 43 now, until I was in my mid-30s. I never gave it a thought until a guy said, you sound like some of these guys. Then I started listening. So I was influenced by them anyway, without really, you know, checking them out.
What do you listen to now? I don't know how much time you spend listening to radio or records.
Well, I usually listen to, I like children's music. I like to hear the children sing. They fascinate me. Children, when they come up with melodies and rhythms, that's what I listen to. I don't really listen to too much, you know. Mm-hmm. Just listen to crickets or something pure.
Wait a minute, you live in Manhattan, don't you?
Huh? Manhattan? No, I live in Queens.
Oh, they have crickets in Queens?
Yeah, I imported some from Mississippi.
You've played with Henry Threadgill a lot in person and recorded with him as well. Has his composition affected your work in any way or your approach to improvisation?
Has it affected my improvisation? I would say it has. It has helped me my improvisation a lot because, see, by me being from a small town and we're not playing these kind of music, these guys from some large cities, we call these big city music players. You know, I call them, that's what I call them, you know, these big city guys. They play this stuff that should be foreign to me, but it's not. And it's like a chess game to me. It's different from my music, I think. When I play that music, it's like figuring out their culture, the big city musician's culture. So it fascinates me for that reason. So I like it. I really like it for that reason also. Just for the fascination of playing another music from another culture. Although it's American, but as far as I'm concerned, it's from another culture. Chicago, big city music. And these people are into things that I don't know anything about. But I do know about it, but I don't know about it. You understand what I'm saying? So it's like a mystery. And now, after so many years of playing with him, I can encompass the music as my own.
So you still feel like an outsider, kind of like a country boy in the city?
Yeah, I must admit, yeah, I do. Because I don't have any peers from my hometown here.
Mm-hmm.
If guys were here from my hometown, I would be playing straight down blues. That's all I would play. Just blues. That's all. That's what we'd be playing, different types of rhythm and blues from down there. Different types. But they're not here. On the East Coast, it's not a blues thing. And I felt pretty bad about that because I had to play other music that I really didn't want to play to survive. You know, it's still that way. In a way, sometimes I don't want to play anything but what I want to play, which is I think is natural, you know. But on the East Coast, it's like I may as well be from, the Ukraine or somewhere, you know. But I manage, you know, I'll, you know, whatever.
We're running out of time, but can you tell us briefly how you got your name, Oludara?
Yoruba priest gave it to me. He threw coconut shells, and he was thinking about me, and he said that he read the shells, and the shells exclaimed to him, that guy you've been playing trumpet with, his name, his original name is Oludara. And I accepted that name right on the spot because it sounded just like me.
Are you happy with it?
I'm very happy.
Do you feel transformed having a different name?
Sure. I mean, when I was a kid, I had many nicknames. Every time they said, call me another name, when they said Junior, when they said Junebug, Chucky, you know, whatever, it transforms you. Just like yourself. Did you ever have a nickname before?
Not really. People shorten my name. But
like
I,
what?
Like Tare instead of Terry, but I haven't really had Tare? A nickname. Yeah.
See what I mean? It's a difference. When somebody, if you had told me your name was Tare, then you would have been Tare. I would have seen you different in a different light just by you saying Tare. Terry, I see you as Terry.
So it affects people and it affects you. You know, just like Ronald Reagan, the actor. Then he crosses out actor and said, President Ronald Reagan. That's another name, right?
Well, I regret we're out of time. It's really been fun to have you here, and I really enjoy your music, and I want to thank you a lot. Can you tell us if you will have an album out in the near future of your own band? I know you're featured on many recent sessions led by other composers, but...
I don't think so. I heard they were going to put some stuff out that I did in 1977 or whatever, but right now I can't find any takers, so I'm going to take it myself, you know, and probably put something out for the people.
Well, if you'd like to hear Olodara's work in the meantime, you can hear him in concert tonight leading his Okra Orchestra at Haverford College. And you can also hear him on David Murray Records, Henry Threadgill, Jamal Adin Takuma, and he's on many other sessions as well. The concert tonight starts at 8 o'clock. It's on the Haverford campus in Roberts Hall. And if you've never been on the campus, there are usually signs up that will expedite your way over there. And for more information or directions, you can call 896-6606. That's 896-6606. And this concert will be recorded for the Voice of America's Jazz Concert Series. And Olodara, thanks a lot again
Thank
for being
you,
here. And Olodara is a jazz trumpeter and composer who now lives in New York. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. All things considered, coming up at 5, I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. For folks heading home on the Roosevelt Boulevard northbound, some slow going approaching 5th Street. There is an accident with a car fire in the inner drive. Police and fire equipment are on the scene. Stick to the outer drive. You'll make much better time. If you're heading home on the Schuylkill Expressway eastbound, some slow going from approaching the Strawberry Mansion Bridge down through South Street, where there's a disabled vehicle blocking the right lane. The westbound side slows from University in through South. Again, some slowing around City Line Avenue. If you're heading out on City Line Avenue southbound, some slowing approaching 54th Street down to Marion Road. That's due in part to an earlier Watermain break. The crews just left a little while ago. Also in Pennsauk and Township, Camden County, an accident on Route 130 at the Airport Circle causing some slow going in all directions heading into the circle. Police are asking you to avoid that area this afternoon. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Jim Battalese.
The Shadow Traffic Report, funded with a grant from Superfresh. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, I'll speak with Michael Gillen, who is a professor of mathematics at Cornell University and author of a new book about mathematical philosophy called Bridges to Infinity. 3:40 Arts reporter Julie Burstein, and at 4 o'clock, station manager Bill Siemering will be with us to discuss new programs coming up on 91 FM. Then we'll open up the telephones and invite you to speak directly with him with your questions and comments about our programming. This Sunday at 2 o'clock on the Best of Fresh Air, interviews with two novelists, William Kennedy, whose novel Ironweed just won the National Book Critics Circle Award and whose recent collection of essays, O Albany, has just been published. Also, we'll hear from Lynn Sharon Schwartz, author of the novel Disturbances in the Field. That's this Sunday at 2 o'clock. Hope you can be listening. Jeff Foreman contributed assistance to today's show. Ron Carson, technical director, Maeve McGoran, associate producer of the show, Danny Miller, the co-producer. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great evening and a good weekend. This is listener-supported public radio in Philadelphia, WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm David Malpass.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
I'm smart enough to pronounce numbers and fractions, count money, understand contractions, and recognize over 80 standard abbreviations. With me you can access information stored on computers, and all you need is a touch-tone telephone.
Talk to a computer, and increasingly it may, like this one, talk back. Tonight on All Things Considered, a computer language we can all understand.
Also, predictions that the unsolved federal deficit may soon trigger a falling stock market and cause foreign investment to flee.
Walter Mondale gets specific on his economic platform, including tax hikes for the wealthy.
New evidence of landfills polluting the air.
And polls polluting our minds.
First, we have this hour's news.
This is Brian Naylor. The United States continues to import far more than it exports. Today, the Commerce Department said the nation chalked up a $69.4 billion merchandise trade deficit in 1983, the worst ever. Analysts say a more robust economic recovery at home than abroad and the strong dollar were responsible for the problem, which is costing millions of jobs and could threaten the recovery. David Ernst, vice president of Evans Economics,